Great. So as Dr. Block mentioned, today we're going to talk about the principles and practice of radiation oncology. So we'll start by talking a little bit about the physical basis of radiation therapy. What are the kinds of radiation that we use in treating our patients? What are the reasons that we choose one radiation over another? We'll talk a little bit about the biological basis of radiation interactions with tissue. How is it that we produce the kind of therapeutic effect that we're hoping for? Then we'll switch gears and talk a little bit about the history of radiation therapy. As you can imagine, the technology that we use has changed drastically over the years, and certainly the acceleration of change has become even more quick now than it was early on when radiation therapy was started. We'll talk about treatment planning. How do we decide what type of radiation we're going to use, and what are the application techniques that we use so that we can safely treat patients? And then we'll end with a bit of a description of some of the technology of treatment delivery, some of the kinds of equipment that we have across the street in the Department of Radiation Therapy that we use to treat our patients every day. If any of you has a question as I'm talking, please go ahead and get my attention. Oftentimes it's easier to address the issue when the image or the slide is still being projected. So let's jump in then. Radiation can be categorized into two different types. We have non-ionizing radiation, which is basically visible light. That's the kind of radiation that is hitting us from the light bulbs that are illuminating this hall. There's also infrared radiation, ultraviolet radiation. These are considered non-ionizing because they do not really create any significant biological effect. They don't create any kind of ionization within the atoms that comprise the cells that our tissue is made of. So they are non-ionizing, and from a therapeutic perspective, they're not very interesting because they don't cause any real biological effect. Ionizing radiation, on the other hand, is of an energy or type that is able to produce ionization within tissue. And that category is subdivided into two different types. We have directly ionizing radiation, which are the charged particles that we can use in radiation therapy. So that would be particles like electrons, like protons, like pi mesons. Any particles that have a charge can produce directly ionizing effects within tissue. Indirectly ionizing radiation are ones that are either uncharged particles, such as neutrons, or components of the electromagnetic spectrum. So that would be X-rays and gamma rays. So these indirectly ionizing radiations have to first create a charged particle as they interact with tissue or with matter, and then that charged particle can go on to create the ionization that ultimately leads to the deposition of dose. Okay, so from our perspective, directly ionizing radiation and indirectly ionizing radiation are interesting because they comprise the types of radiation that we can use to deliver radiation therapy to patients, that we can use to deliver dose. So let's concentrate then on ionizing radiation, and let's look at the category of X-rays first, because that's how the most dominant type of radiation therapy across this country is delivered. It's delivered with X-rays. Now, X-rays result from extranuclear processes. It's really two ways that X-rays can result. There's a so-called characteristic radiation, which happens when the electrons within an atom, when they change shells, when they move from one shell to another. When that happens, there's a change in binding energy of the electron, and then that change results in the emission of an X-ray. In that case, it's called a characteristic X-ray. There's also another category that's called bremsstrahlung radiation. And the way this one works is anytime you have a charged particle, such as an electron, let's say, and that charged particle is either accelerated or decelerated, it is going to emit radiation. And that radiation is called bremsstrahlung radiation. Bremsstrahlung is a German word that means breaking radiation. So the charged particle has some force on it that causes it to decelerate or accelerate. It's like someone putting the brakes on a car. And in that process, it emits some radiation. So these are the only two categories of X-rays that there are out there. Gamma rays, on the other hand, result in intranuclear processes. So one question I like to ask is, what is the difference between a gamma ray and an X-ray? If you have a gamma ray of a given energy and an X-ray of the exact same energy, can you tell the difference between the two? Any thoughts? What does the general population think the difference is between a gamma ray and an X-ray? Which are considered more dangerous? Gamma rays, right? Everyone thinks gamma rays, ooh, scary stuff, whereas X-rays are okay. The truth is that X-rays and gamma rays are exactly the same. The only difference is where they originate from. So we just talked about how X-rays are produced, and they originate from processes that happen outside of the nucleus of the atom, right? Either an electron drops from one shell to the other, giving off a characteristic X-ray, or an electron somehow gets its path deflected, thereby being accelerated, and gives off an X-ray. It's called Bremsstrahlung radiation. Both of those interactions happen outside of the nucleus. Gamma rays, on the other hand, occur within the nucleus. So you've all heard of uranium decay and cobalt-60 decay. What happens in those decay processes is that the nucleus within those atoms somehow rearranges itself. The nucleus is in an excited state, doesn't like to be in an excited state, wants to get closer to its ground state, and in the process of achieving that, it gives off some energy in the form of a gamma ray. Okay? So that's the difference between an X-ray and a gamma ray. A gamma ray occurs within the nucleus, an X-ray is produced outside of the nucleus. So if I give you two identical, let's say an X-ray of a given energy and a gamma ray of a given energy, once they're produced, you're not going to be able to tell the difference. From a therapeutic perspective, they're also the same. Okay? The only difference is where they originate from. So we just talked about how gamma rays originate from nuclear decay, okay, where the nucleus goes from an excited state to at least a point closer to its ground state. And then in that decay, there's some parameters that we can use to characterize the kinetics that are associated with that decay. So certainly everyone has heard of the half-life for decay, right? Maybe we've heard of decay constant and specific activity. These are all parameters that we use when we're describing a type of radiation source that we might use to apply radiation to a patient. So if we look at some common isotopes that have been used in radiation therapy, we can categorize them according to the isotope name, its half-life, and then the energy of the gamma ray, or the radiation that is emitted. So cobalt-60 is a very commonly used isotope. In fact, we have a machine across the street that is loaded with cobalt-60 that we use to deliver treatments to our patients. Now, the half-life for cobalt-60 is about 5.25 years, and the energy of emission of the gamma ray is 1.25 MeV. Now, you may not have a good feeling for the unit of MeV, but this quantity right here, 1.25 MeV, is actually quite good for treating patients because the radiation is penetrating enough, it has a high enough energy that it can travel into a patient. So if the patient has a tumor somewhere, let's say, in the head and neck area or in the brain or even in the thorax, that radiation will reach the tumor. It's high enough in energy. It's also not so high that it would primarily just go through the patient and not interact effectively. So this is almost the perfect radioisotope, the perfect energy for treatments in the brain, the head and neck, and upper thorax. Cesium-137 was another isotope that had clinical applications. It's nice in the sense that its half-life is longer. Why is the magnitude of the half-life an important consideration for us? What do you think? Why would a longer half-life isotope be better than a short-lived isotope from the perspective of delivering radiation dose? Any thoughts? I'm sorry? Yeah. So if it's active longer, that means that we can keep it in our machine longer without having to change it. So as you can imagine, changing radioisotopes in a radiation-delivering machine is not something you can just pick up, you know, the new one and put it in the machine, right? There's an elaborate process that's associated with changing out a radiation source in a machine. And that elaborate process, right, elaborate by definition means complicated and expensive, right? That's elaborate in this case. So you don't like to do that more frequently than you need to. If your isotope has a 30-year half-life, that means that you may have to only do it once every 30 to 40 years, right? Once during your career, if you're lucky. If your isotope has a half-life of 5 1/4 years, you're going to do it several times, right? And you're going to follow that elaborate process several times. So cesium, from that perspective, is better. However, look at the energy of emission. It's lower, right? So it's not as effective in delivering dose to patients that have deep-seated tumors. So there's a compromise here. This is better therapeutically for patients, so of course that's the decision that's made in terms of what isotope you're going to pick. Even though this one, from the pragmatic operational perspective, would be better. But it's not as good at delivering radiation to patients. A couple of other isotopes that have had clinical applications, iodine-125, palladium-103, these have really short half-lives, right? 60 days and 17 days, and very low energy. 28 keV, this is two orders of magnitude less than those energies right there. So what are the applications that you can think of where we might want to use iodine-125 and palladium-103? Looking at just the half-life parameter and looking at just the energy parameter. Yes, sir? You could if you're doing any kind of imaging, right? Yeah, but if we concentrate only on therapeutic applications, where would this type of source, given the half-life and the energy, be more effective than maybe one of these sources where the half-life is longer and the energy is certainly much higher? I'm sorry? So you're saying if you put the source directly into the patient, right, into the target, and leave it there, maybe forever, right? Yeah, that's exactly it. So what we have used iodine and palladium for in the past, and some places still do, is prostate radiation therapy, where you have seeds, right, that are either iodine or palladium, and you put those seeds directly into the patient's prostate. I've got a slide that shows that a little bit later. And because the half-life is short, relatively short, it will decay over time and deliver its radiation dose. So you can leave them in there forever, because eventually they will just get to no radiation anymore anyway, and if it's a sterile seed, it doesn't matter if it's in the patient's prostate. Plus, the energy is very low. And why would that be good if you're putting the source directly into where it needs to go? You'll have fewer side effects because the radiation, if you do it right, is going to stay just in the volume that needs the radiation. And any other structures that are around the volume will get much less radiation dose. So you see how the thought process really has to take into consideration a lot of different factors when you're deciding what type of radiation you're going to use to treat patients. And we'll see a lot more of this as we continue. So here is a depiction of the electromagnetic spectrum. And what I'm trying to show here is that the components that we use for radiation therapy, which are over here, are just a small part of the continuous spectrum that includes visible light, it includes microwaves, it includes radio waves. All of these are part of the overall concept known as electromagnetic radiation, where the product of the frequency of the radiation and the wavelength is a constant, right? And that's equal to the speed of light in vacuum. So gamma rays, X-rays, all these other components all follow that one physical premise where the speed of that entity, basically the speed of light, or C, is equal to the frequency times the wavelength. Okay, so they're all the same. Now these components, particularly the ones that we're interested in, the X-rays and the gamma rays, they interact with the patient or with any material that's being irradiated in one of these three interaction mechanisms. It's either going to be the photoelectric interaction, it's going to be the Compton interaction, or pair production. Because these are components of the electromagnetic spectrum, the way they interact is very much probability-based. So there is a probability, non-zero probability, that the photon can go all the way through a patient and not interact. But the likelihood of that happening is very small for the types of radiation that we use. So let's take a look at these individual interaction mechanisms and get an idea of how they operate. So here's a schematic diagram that shows the photoelectric interaction. So this would be an atom that would comprise the patient's cells or whatever material you happen to be irradiating. You've got the nucleus, and then these are the electrons that are circling the nucleus. So the X-ray or the gamma ray comes in, and if it is going to undergo a photoelectric interaction, the X-ray interacts with an inner shell electron, in this case that guy right there. The X-ray then disappears. It transfers all of its energy to that inner shell electron, which after the collision is ejected from the atom. Okay, that's called a photoelectron. So what you're left with then is the photon disappears, an energetic electron is created, and what about this atom? Is this atom in a stable state right now? It's not, right? Because one of its inner shell electrons is missing, so it has a vacancy. So this atom has to undergo certain things in order to get back down to its ground state. But the bottom line here, the thing I want you to focus on, is that the X-ray or gamma ray, the photon disappears, and you're left with an electron, photoelectron. So think now along the lines of what we started talking about, where we said that an indirectly ionizing radiation, right, it has to create a charged particle before it can manifest dose. Kind of what happened here, right? We created an electron through the interaction of this photon with the patient. Let's look at Compton scattering. Same idea. Here we have an incident X-ray or gamma ray that's going to interact with an atom. This atom is a little fancier than the one we showed in photoelectric interaction. But here you've got the nucleus, and then these are all the electrons that are circling the nucleus. The photon interacts this time with an outer shell electron. Okay, that's an electron that's far away from the nucleus. And in this case, the photon does not completely disappear. We get a scattered photon with lower energy. Okay, and then we also get, again, an electron. This time it's called a Compton recoil electron. But the bottom line is the same. We started out with an indirectly ionizing radiation that before it's going to deposit dose, it has to create an electron. And that's exactly what happened here as well in the Compton interaction. Although, an additional side product is a scattered photon of lower energy. And then pair production, that's the third possible mechanism. And here, what we get is a photon that interacts, this time within the electrostatic field of the nucleus. Okay, so it doesn't collide into the nucleus, it doesn't interact with an orbital electron, it just sort of comes close to the nucleus, feels the electrostatic attraction to the nucleus, and then undergoes this pair production process. And the end result of that process is that the photon disappears and we get an electron and positron pair that is created. So again, we have the creation of an electron, right? A charged particle through interaction of the photon with the material, either patient or phantom or whatever it is that we happen to be irradiating. So what's the common byproduct of these three mechanisms that we talked about? It's an electron, right? And it's really that electron that goes on from its point of origin within the patient that then results in the deposition of dose. Okay, so it's the electron that creates the dose, not the photon directly. Okay, let's talk a little bit about charged particles now, because we know that we can use charged particles, right, directly ionizing radiation, to also deliver dose. In our clinic, across the street, we have machines that can produce electron beams. And there are some clinical indications that are better treated with electron beams than with X-ray beams. So we treat patients that way as well. Now, charged particles, electrons, protons as well, you've probably all heard of proton therapy. There are other types of particles that can also be used, but they all interact through collisional and radiative mechanisms. So it's not probability-based anymore, the way it was with photons. Now it's more based on direct collisions between the particle and some component of the patient's atomic structure, or radiative mechanisms. And these have predictable finite ranges. So for protons, for electrons, as they interact with a patient, I can tell you how far that beam is going to penetrate into the patient, and then beyond that depth, there will no longer be any dose. So you can see how that could actually be quite useful if you have a patient that has a target, and then immediately downstream or adjacent to the target, there's some normal structure that you want to protect, some radiosensitive structure that if you irradiate it to too high a dose, the patient will have complications. So in that scenario, you might want to pick an electron beam and select the energy of the electron beam such that the penetration, right, which is very well defined, will reach only the distal end of the target and not go into the sensitive structure that is downstream from the target. So that's how charged particles can be used. Protons provide you the same benefit. Only the mechanisms are a little different. The machines are much more expensive and they're in limited availability. Certainly not as available as electrons are for radiation therapy. So let's take a look now at how we consider different types of radiation and also different energies of radiation. So what we're showing here is called percent depth dose as a function of depth in water. So if you consider that you have a patient lying on a table, right? Patients are basically water equivalent. So patients lying on a table and you are shining a radiation beam on the patient, right? One beam straight down on the patient. If you now look at how dose is deposited as you go deeper into the patient, you would get a curve that looks something like this. So on the surface of the patient, you have very low dose. You get what's called dose buildup as you go deeper into the patient, reaching some maximum, and then you get that exponential decay, probability-based decay or decrease in dose that we talked about as the interactions take place. Now, the higher the beam energy, don't worry about the unit here, but just look at the relative magnitude of the unit. The higher the beam energy, the more penetrating the radiation is going to be. So this now starts the thought process for us that if we have a patient that has a tumor that's maybe a little bit deeper than another patient, you might want to use the higher energy radiation for that patient and use the lower energy radiation for the patient whose tumor is more superficial. Okay? That is the thought process that we use in terms of selecting beam energy. If we look at this set of depth dose curves over here, this is for electron beams. And you'll notice right away that the shape is different, right? This has a probability that it can go out all the way to infinity, or certainly right through the patient without interacting. Electron beams, as we talked about just a minute ago, have this practical range beyond which, right, the dose is basically zero. And the depth of that practical range is dependent upon the energy of the electron beam. And again, don't worry about the unit here, but just look at the magnitude of the unit, where the higher energy beam is, of course, able to penetrate more deeply than the lower energy beam. So this type of data here allows us to select an appropriate energy for a patient given knowledge of where that patient's target is, right? How deep is it within the patient? How far do we need to go? And what are the sensitive structures that we don't want to irradiate? So you all kind of have a little bit of a grasp here of the difference between how X-ray beams interact and how electron beams interact and why we would pick one over the other. I think this graph here shows it very nicely. Okay. Let's switch gears a little bit. We've talked about physical processes of dose deposition, how is dose deposited. Let's now talk a little bit about radiobiology and what are the overall endpoints that we look for when we irradiate a patient. So we talked about how it's actually energy that's deposited within a patient. Right? That's what we do when we create that electron as the photon, if we're doing photon radiation therapy, interacts with the patient. And then that energy deposition, which is basically dose, it leads to some set of reactions or events which ultimately, which hopefully, lead to whatever clinical effect is that we're trying to produce, right? Either killing cells, if it's a patient's tumor, or rendering the cells such that they can no longer divide, or whatever we're trying to produce for that patient. We do it by depositing energy, and then that energy goes on and creates the clinical effect that we're interested in. So we saw how energy transfer to material is not directly through the photons that we use, but it's through the electrons and positrons, if it happens to be pair production. They're produced, and then those particles go on and deposit their energy, which leads to the clinical effect. Cell killing is a multi-step process. You can't irradiate a cell and necessarily expect it to die right away. You have to first absorb energy from the electrons within some critical volume, some critical target within the cell. That has to be the first step. And that can occur as ionization or excitation in the critical volume, leading to molecular damage, which will then render the cell unable to divide, or which will kill it, or which will create the kind of effect that we're hoping for. Now, that damage will prevent normal DNA replication and cell division, which is an endpoint that we look for. If we're trying to diminish the size of a patient's tumor, certainly that's what we would look for. If we're trying to prevent the tumor from growing further, that's what we would look for as well. And sometimes that's the clinical effect that we're interested in producing. Two mechanisms of cell kill. It's a strand of DNA over here. We have indirect action, where the photon interacts with the water, right? It's close to the DNA within the nucleus, and then produces these free radicals, which themselves then go and cause the damage on the strand. Okay, that's known as indirect action. Or we can have a photon directly interacting with the strand and producing the kind of damage that we hope will lead to the clinical outcome. Which of these do you think is more likely to occur? Indirect action or direct action? It's a 50-50 chance if you don't think about it. Put a little bit of thought into it. Which is more likely to occur? Why? Exactly. Or in other words, direct action is unlikely because the target for direct action is very small relative to the target for indirect action, right? So it's more likely that a photon is going to find water here to interact with than this tiny strand to interact with. So certainly the likelihood of indirect action is much, much greater than the likelihood of this target being hit here. It's kind of like winning the lottery, right? You're more likely to win some small amount of money than actually hitting all numbers that you need to win the jackpot. Okay, it's the same idea over here. So if we now move up to cellular response, so we're going one level higher, what kind of response are we going to find? Well, you could find mutation. You could cause some sort of carcinogenesis as well within the cell, or you could kill the cell, right? Interface cell death or apoptosis. That's one endpoint that would produce a clinical effect that actually might be good for us in terms of what we're trying to do for the patient. You could also have loss of reproductive ability, right? The cell, while it may not die, it won't be able to reproduce, right? Which would be okay too if it happens to be a tumor cell. If it's a normal cell, that may not be so good, right? Because then you're going to do some damage there that could result in side effects for the patient. When we consider how radiation is interacting with cells, we like to look at cell survival curves. And here what we're doing is we're plotting the surviving fraction, how many cells actually survive a certain dose of applied radiation. And as expected, the higher the radiation dose that we apply, right, the surviving fraction is going to be lower. It just makes sense. The more energy you put into killing cells, right, or at least not allowing them to reproduce, the more of them you are actually going to impact that way. If you deliver small amounts of radiation, well, then you're going to impact the cell much less. We'll talk a little bit later about the difference between this curve right here and this curve right here. There are actually therapeutic processes and paradigms that we use that create the situation where when we irradiate patients, we're actually looking for survival that is mimicked or patterned more by this line rather than this line right here. The bottom line is the more dose you put into a cell, the lower the surviving fraction is going to be. Now, there are a few other issues that go into the response of cells. How much kill are you actually going to produce? One is inherent radiosensitivity. Different cell types have different sensitivities to the same amount of radiation dose, and that's pretty well established. Same is true for different tumor types, right, that are comprised of these cells. So there are certain tumors that are very radiosensitive and other tumors that are very radioresistant. Oxygen concentration is an important issue to look at as well. When a tumor is well oxygenated, okay, when it has a lot of blood supply surrounding it, it will be more radiosensitive than a tumor that is either hypoxic, where it's in an area of hypoxia, it doesn't have a very good supply of blood, or when it is anoxic, which means that it is completely away from any kind of vessel that could provide it with oxygen. Those cells, the ones that are far away from a source of oxygen, are going to be radioresistant. So most tumors actually have different parts that are either well oxygenated, poorly oxygenated, or not oxygenated at all. The parts that are not oxygenated are very difficult to kill, very difficult to produce any kind of radiation response, whereas the parts that are well oxygenated are relatively easy to produce the kind of response that we're looking for. This leads to a parameter called the oxygen enhancement ratio, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. Certain cells are better able to repair damage than others. So even amongst cells that have different radiosensitivities, you have repair processes that define how well a cell or a group of cells can repair the kind of damage that's produced as energy is deposited. That leads to potentially lethal damage. Some cells can repair that better than others. There's also a dependence of radiosensitivity on what part of the cell cycle the cell happens to be in. So different parts are more sensitive to radiation than other parts. And then the cell proliferation status. How rapidly is that particular cell type dividing? These are all concepts and parameters that we need to take into consideration when we are kind of getting an idea as to how a tumor type is going to respond to a given dose of radiation. A couple parameters that we talk about as well in radiobiology, the linear energy transfer, or LET. This is more a parameter that defines a radiation type. Okay, it's not really a biological parameter, it's more of a physical parameter. And this gives us information about the energy the amount of energy that's deposited per unit path length. So if I give you two radiations, one deposits a lot of energy per unit path length, and the other one deposits less energy per unit path length, which one is going to produce the greater biological effect, all other considerations being equal? Again, 50-50 if you don't think about it. It'd be the one that produces, that has the highest amount of energy deposited per unit path length, right? Because you're going to have the most likelihood that you're going to hit that DNA strand, or the most likelihood that the indirect action producing the free radicals is then going to create some sort of problem for the DNA. So that's why high LET radiation is more efficient at producing radiation damage. There's also the relative biological effectiveness, which measures the efficiency of a given amount of radiation dose in producing damage. Okay? So there are different types of radiation. This is just the standard, the baseline for radiation damage. And then we compare all other radiations in terms of delivering a radiation dose to what kind of damage this radiation would produce with the same radiation dose. Okay, so that's called the relative biological effectiveness, or RBE. It's another radiobiology concept. We talked a minute or so ago about the oxygen enhancement ratio, And we mentioned how oxygenated cells are more sensitive to radiation damage, right? And that also means that anoxic cells are radioresistant. Okay. So the oxygen enhancement ratio is an important radiobiological parameter, right? Now we've transitioned to radiobiological parameters from the physical parameters. And then radioprotectors and radiosensitizers are also important, because if we're trying to optimize the therapeutic effect for a tumor which is radioresistant, right, which is by its own nature resistant to radiation damage, if we can find a radiosensitizer that would have an impact on that particular tumor type, it might be able to increase the therapeutic effect of an amount of radiation that we would apply, because we would make it more radiosensitive. On the flip side, if we have some normal tissue that we are concerned about irradiating because the patient will have side effects, we can include some radioprotectors that might make that normal tissue maybe a little more radioresistant, which would be a good thing for normal tissue. So these are all concepts that we use that have been applied in determining what kind of radiation is going to be used and also what amount of radiation is going to be used. Okay, let's go one level higher now. So we're going to go from cells now to tumors, tumor response, right? Groups of cells. So when we talk about tumor response, the concept of the four R's of radiobiology are very important. And those four R's are repair, repopulation, reoxygenation, and reassortment. So let's go through each one individually and get an idea of what they mean. The four R's of radiobiology are all very important when it comes to the concept known as dose fractionation. When we apply radiation to our patients, generally speaking, we don't give the entire dose in one setting or one fraction. It's kind of like when you get an antibiotic for an infection that you might have. Generally speaking, you don't get just one pill, right, that you take and then you're considered cured. It doesn't work that way. You get multiple pills, smaller doses, right, each pill, that you have to take over a 7-day time period, 10-day, 20-day, whatever the case may be. It's the same with radiation therapy. A patient does not come for treatment only once, generally. There are instances where that does work, but generally speaking, a patient will have to come for treatment every single day for small applications of radiation over a period of weeks. It could be 2 weeks, it could be all the way out to 9 weeks. That's the longest fractionation schedule that we have right now, currently. So that means that every day that the patient comes, we give a small amount of radiation, and each time the patient comes, we then produce a little bit of damage to the patient's tumor. We also, of course, produce a little bit of damage to the patient's normal tissue. Why, based on what I just said, would dose fractionation actually make sense? What would be the important consideration that would make dose fractionation make sense, given the response of malignant cells relative to the response of normal cells? So the malignant cells, if this worked very well, right, the malignant cells would suffer more damage than the normal cells, right? That's not necessarily the case. What saves us in those instances when that isn't the case? What's the other parameter, the other thing that's in play when you fractionate those? Exactly. That's the important consideration as well, right? Even if cancer cells and normal cells suffer the same damage, let's say, from that one application, the normal tissue is better able to repair that damage between fractions so that you have a net benefit in terms of kill, right? You may have killed or you may have damaged or deposited equal amounts of energy in the cancer cells and the normal cells, but the normal cells will repair some of that damage more efficiently than the cancer cells will. So the overall therapeutic effect is enhanced. If that doesn't work, right? If that's not the case, then fractionation is useless. Then you might as well just deliver the entire dose in one shot and save the hassle for the patient having to come each and every day for treatment for a number of weeks, right? So dividing a dose into a number of fractions, it spares normal tissues, okay, like we just talked about, because the repair of sublethal damage is usually more efficient in normal tissue than it is in malignant tissue cells. Repopulation of normal cells also, generally speaking, happens more efficiently than repopulation of malignant cells. So we have a net benefit there. Dose fractionation also increases damage to tumor cells. We talked earlier about how oxygenated cells are more radiosensitive than anoxic cells. Between fractions, those cells that happen to be far away from a source of oxygen, right, they can get closer to a source of oxygen if the ones that are between them and the source of oxygen die off because they were killed by the application of radiation. So between fractions, you can have reoxygenation that can occur such that those parts of the tumor that were hypoxic or anoxic become better oxygenated. So they're more sensitive the next time you apply a fraction of radiation. And then between fractions, you can also have reassortment of the cells into more radiosensitive phases of their cell cycle, right? Because that sort of happens at random. So the next time that the patient comes, their tumor, parts of their tumor, certain cells within their tumor might be in more radiosensitive parts of the cell cycle. So you will be able to inactivate those more efficiently. Okay? So these are the concepts that suggest why dose fractionation actually works for patients. So let's talk again about the cell survival curve. We talked about this earlier where we saw how as we increase the dose, we get lower surviving fraction, right? We inactivated more cells. This is for a single fraction. This is when you give the entire dose in one shot. This is what happens when you break up the entire dose into smaller doses with a certain amount of time in between, usually about a day between applications. So you get this kind of cell kill each day, but between the fractions, you get some repair that happens. So while the surviving fraction, right, to get to a certain level of kill requires a much higher dose when you are fractionating the dose, the fact that you've got some repair happening in the normal tissue makes this a reasonable approach to use for those patients. Okay, so the overall dose has to be higher if you're fractionating, but the overall therapeutic effect for the patient is going to be better. Maybe not from the perspective of the tumor, but certainly from the perspective of the normal tissue that surrounds the tumor. Okay, does that make sense? All right. Two concepts that are very important when we talk about tissue and organ response to fractionated radiation therapy. So we have the concept known as TCP. That is the probability that the tumor is going to be controlled, that you will either stop the growth, right, cause the tumor to regress, certainly not, we hope that it isn't going to grow through the application of radiation. So that is the parameter that gives us an idea of how likely it is for a given dose that we are going to inactivate or at least control the tumor. That's not the only issue of concern for us, though. We also have normal tissue that we have to worry about. And NTCP gives us the probability that we're going to create complications in the normal cells, the normal tissue that surrounds the patient's tumor. So that's the likelihood of complications that are going to be produced. If we look at tumor control probability, we've got this sigmoid-shaped curve, where here is the probability ranging from 0 up to 100% as a function of applied dose. So as we expect, as the dose increases, the likelihood, right, that we're going to control the tumor also increases. So we can look and see that at this particular dose level, we only have a 10% chance that we're going to control the patient's tumor. Not very good, right? I would argue that we're going to want to increase the dose for this patient so that we can tell them that there's a better likelihood that their tumor will be controlled. So we might want to go to this dose level right here where we've got a 90% chance that the patient's tumor is going to be controlled. So you might argue, well, why don't we even go to a higher dose, right, so that we can have 100% probability? What's the problem with that? What are we not considering if we look only at this parameter? Normal tissues, right? So let's take a look and see what happens when we consider normal tissue. So this is a TCP curve that we just saw. Here is superimposed on the same scale the normal tissue complication probability. So for our dose A, which provided a 10% likelihood that we're going to control the patient's disease, there's really no likelihood that there's going to be any complications for that patient. So from the perspective of normal tissue side effects, the patient won't suffer any. Probably won't be cured, and certainly they won't be controlled. The disease won't be controlled by that small dose. So if we now go to dose C, we've got a 90% chance of controlling the target, the tumor. Very good, right? However, we've also created about a 70% chance that that patient's going to have significant normal tissue complications, which probably isn't the approach that we would take, because those complications can really create some quality of life issues for patients after they're done with us. So more than likely, we'll operate somewhere around here, somewhere between dose B and dose C, where we've got a respectable likelihood of tumor control, right, 70% or higher, and at the same time, a reasonable complication probability in normal tissues as well of about 10%, right? So this is why radiation therapy works. If the NTCP curve were on the other side of the tumor complication probability curve, can you see how radiation therapy wouldn't work? Right? You wouldn't be able to get a therapeutic dose into the patient without creating severe complications. And there are some tumor types where these two are very close. And those are the ones that are very difficult to treat with radiation, because you can control the tumor, but you're going to create some very significant complications for the patients. So those are ones that we have other ways that we can treat those patients. Radiation may not be the best approach for them. Okay, radiation therapy history. This goes back now well over 100 years. 1895, Rentgen discovered X-rays. Very shortly after that, Becquerel in 1896, Marie Curie, she's very famous, you've probably all heard of her, she discovers radium-226. Within about 3 years, we already knew what the clinical ramifications, right, the biological ramifications were, because Pierre Curie took a piece of this radium, stuck it on his arm, and lo and behold, he got a radiation burn. So he saw right away that there are some clinical, potentially useful clinical applications of radiation. So the biological effect then was pretty well figured out at that point. And early radiation therapy used radium as the source of radiation, because that's all that we really had back then. We couldn't really use X-rays yet, because the energy of the X-rays was so low that we couldn't get the dose to penetrate within the patient. So it was pretty much limited to applications of radium early on. Here's Rentgen, and this is remarkable because this is an image, a picture of the first X-ray that was ever taken. It was in Rentgen's lab. His wife happened to come and visit him, and her hand passed between a source of X-rays in an imaging plate. He wasn't really doing studies on X-rays at the time. He was doing something else. But when he saw this image on the plate, right then and there, he immediately saw that there are some applications for this, because he could see inside his wife's hand, right? There's her wedding ring, and you can see the finger bones and so on. And it's remarkable that even today, if you take an X-ray of a person's hand, it's not going to look much different than this first X-ray that was ever applied. Quite remarkable. And then here are just some stamps that memorialize Rentgen over here. And then we've got Becquerel, and then Pierre and Marie Curie as they did their work as well. So here's a picture of Pierre Curie's arm in 1901. And I think you can see exactly where he placed the radiation source. And this probably would not have healed, because the damage that was produced necrotic tissue, which was not going to heal. Now, why did he not have any complications from this? Who knows the story of Pierre Curie? He didn't live long enough, to see any complications. Now, generally, a lot of the early researchers in this field, they died from leukemia, right? Because they exposed themselves to radiation, whole body radiation. They didn't know what the radiation effects were going to be on their biological systems. In his case, he actually died before he could get leukemia. He got hit in the head by a horse, actually. In that day and age, there were horse and buggies. There were no cars. And he was doing something with his horse, and the horse kicked him in the head, and that's what killed him. And in a way, he was actually lucky, because it was probably a less painful death than the one that Marie Curie or a lot of his contemporaries suffered because of the malignancies that they produced. So he never saw a true biological effect from this radiation burn. This, on the other hand, was an early application of radiation therapy to a patient. This poor guy probably had some head and neck malignancy, maybe something in his mouth. And what they did in 1922 was they took this surface plaque, and each of these tubes here, cylinders, was a radium-226 source. So this was put on this plaque, which was taped to his face, and it was left there for as long as he could tolerate the application, maybe a few days. At the point where the pain just became too great, they would then take it off, and they would tell the guy, okay, go home. That's all that we can do for you. It was state-of-the-art back then, but certainly there was no quantitative evaluation of the dose, right? That's called dosimetry. That's the quantitative measure of radiation dose. They didn't do that back then. And there was a complete disregard for radiation safety as well. Nurses that would have tended to this patient, they weren't concerned about the radiation exposure, the physicians, the family members. It was state-of-the-art back then, right? Kind of looks like torture, actually. We can contrast that with what we can do today. So here's another example of a patient with likely a similar tumor in the head and neck region over here. So this is a sagittal reconstruction of the patient's CT scan. You got the brain up here, the eyes, the nasal cavity, the mouth over here. And then shaded, contoured in red over here would be what we would consider the target for the patient. So that's where we want to apply radiation. That's the patient's tumor, plus a little bit of margin to account for microscopic disease. That becomes a target for us. It was a target back in 1922 for that previous patient as well, only they weren't able to visualize it the way we can today, and they also weren't able to tailor the dose, right? This is a dose wash, color wash over here, where the red part indicates the highest dose that we're applying, and then as we get progressively towards blue, it gets colder, right? So here, not only can we shape the dose to the target, the irregular shape of the target, but what's also the important consideration here? What else do you see here that's very important to consider? What's the normal tissue that we worry about in the vicinity of this anatomy? Spinal cord, exactly, right back here. What else? Brainstem, right, up here. You've got the mouth. You've got the parotid glands, you've got the salivary glands, all those structures. While maybe if you overdose the patient's salivary gland, you're not going to kill them, but you're going to impact their quality of life afterwards. Certainly if you overdose the spinal cord, you're going to kill the patient. So we now have the capability of really shaping the dose such that for this particular type of patient, we can keep the blue part of the distribution where the cord is and where the mouth is, certainly where the brainstem is, and just keep the high dose part limited just to the patient's target. Okay? Couldn't do that in 1922, but certainly today we're able to do that. So the modern radiation therapy team then includes these professionals. We've got the radiation oncologist and the resident that are responsible for all aspects, all clinical care aspects of the patient. You got a medical physicist, also a resident, that are responsible for delivery of the dose to the patient, for verifying the accuracy and coming up with new techniques that dose can be delivered. Then there's a dosimetrist, radiation therapist, nurse, social worker, and administrator. In our department across the street, we've got about 100 people that comprise this team that are all charged with treating our patients on a daily basis. So it's a it's a large-scale operation. We treat anywhere from 120 to 160 patients per day on our machine in an 8-hour day. So it's a large operation. The goal of radiation therapy, then, from a systemic perspective, is to concentrate the dose to target tissues, right? You want to put the dose where it needs to go, and at the same time, minimize the dose to any healthy tissues that surround the target. So in the example we just saw, the healthy tissues to which we would want to minimize dose would be the spinal cord, certainly the brainstem, patient's parotid glands, salivary glands. Any tissue that doesn't need radiation applied, we ought to try and limit the dose to it so the patient will not suffer side effects, so it won't impact their quality of life. The way we do satisfy that goal, the way we treat patients, is we have two approaches. We have a paradigm called teletherapy, where we have the source of radiation outside of the patient's body, and then we apply radiation through beams that traverse the patient and then gets to wherever the patient's target happens to be, right, the tumor. That's called teletherapy, or therapy at a large distance. And we have brachytherapy, which is the opposite. It's kind of like the example we talked about earlier, where we take a seed of iodine or palladium and we put it directly into the patient's prostate, right? That's brachytherapy, therapy at a short distance, where the sources are placed directly into the tumor volume. Certainly from the perspective of irradiating normal tissue, brachytherapy is a better approach because you can put the source right where it needs to go. Problem is, it's a surgical procedure often, certainly invasive, and it's not the right approach for all types of tumors because you can't get sources everywhere into the patient's body. So oftentimes, in a radiation therapy department, you have both approaches that are used in delivering radiation therapy to patients. Certainly in our department, we have both capabilities. So if we look at brachytherapy, here, for example, is a patient's prostate, mid-gland, and then here we would be at the apex of the gland. And what you're looking at then, these enhancements here are seeds that we placed into the patient's prostate. And then these lines here are what we're defining as the target, right? What we're defining as the patient's prostate. So this would be a nice application of brachytherapy because we can get the sources directly where they need to go without too much complication or risk for the patient. Now, brachytherapy can be applied to many anatomical sites. In fact, we've applied it to the patient's eye, head, neck, brain, skin, lung, esophagus, breast, prostate, GYN applications, soft tissue sarcoma. Many, many different kinds of targets of tumor types have been treated with brachytherapy. Here's an example of prostate brachytherapy again, where you've got two different approaches. This is sort of the modern approach now, where you do this under ultrasound guidance. So you got the patient's bladder over here, the prostate, the urethra, and then you have an ultrasound probe that's put into the patient's rectum, which allows imaging of the prostate real time as the seeds are being applied. It's very important that you know where the seeds are going, and really the only way you can do that, at least in a real-time approach, is using ultrasound. So that's a viable treatment for patients that are okay with this type of approach. This is the way you would get the seeds into the patient. And then once the seeds are there, you want to do some sort of verification that you've properly positioned them. So you can do a plain film x-ray, right? And then these would be the seeds that would be generally in the vicinity that you would expect the prostate to be in. But do you see prostate on this plain film? You really don't. Right? You don't see soft tissue on plain film radiography. You have to do a CT scan. So if you take this patient and then you acquire a CT scan, then what you would see is the prostate outlined in red, and then each of these enhancements, contrast enhancements, would be a seed that was put in there. So generally you're going to put somewhere between 70 and 120 seeds depending on the size of the patient's prostate, and then you leave them there. You leave them there, and as they interact with the patient's prostate, they deliver dose, and hopefully that dose will produce the therapeutic effect that you're looking for. Here's another instance. This patient is undergoing treatment for esophageal cancer. So we have an applicator that is put down the patient's esophagus, and then this machine will apply a radiation source, which will go to pre-programmed stopping points within the patient's esophagus and then sit there or dwell there for a certain period of time, usually seconds to minutes, and deliver radiation that way. Once the entire dose has been delivered, then the source comes out, we remove the applicator, and the patient's free to go home. So this is one application where we treat a patient's esophagus. Here's a head and neck base of tongue application where we applied catheters through the patient's floor of the mouth over here, coming out the cheek, and then into those applicators we would put radiation sources that would be in the patient during that time. The sources would interact, right? The radiation coming from the sources would deliver dose. Once the dose was delivered, at that point we pull everything out and the patient recovers afterwards, and hopefully we get the therapeutic effect that we are hoping for the patient. Let's talk a little bit about teletherapy now. This is radiation that's applied not through sources that are put into the patient, but through machines where the source of radiation is outside of the patient's body. So we have three different ranges here that are it's kind of arbitrarily set, but the one that's most important from our perspective is this megavoltage range, right? We already talked about how cobalt is a very good isotope for radiation therapy delivery because the gamma ray that comes off of it is at an appropriate energy for delivering dose to patients that have tumors. As we increase the energy, it gets even better than that. So a lot of the beams that we use are actually higher in energy than cobalt 60. We also have orthovoltage range, which is lower, and then superficial, which is even lower. So if a patient has a skin malignancy, oftentimes you wouldn't want to use a very high megavoltage beam. You would want to use something a little bit lower in energy because the target is superficial. In that case, if a patient has a prostate tumor or something else where it's deep inside the anatomy, then you have to use something that's higher in energy. Here's a real, very quick snapshot of some of the technology that has been used historically, ranging from very early X-ray tubes, kind of hard to see what these guys are doing over here, to these kind of like Van de Graaff generators, which produce X-rays in a certain way, all the way through to linear accelerators. This is kind of the standard right now, the C-arm linear accelerator. I'll show you in a minute how this is applied to a patient. And then here's a new concept called tomotherapy. Sort of looks like a CT scanner or an MR scanner, where radiation is applied in an arc around the patient. So it's sort of a new concept. Bottom line is, all of these different approaches have been used to deliver radiation dose, some more successfully than others, of course, over the years. Here's a superficial X-ray tube that we have in our department, used primarily for surface or skin lesions that we would want to treat. And here is a linear accelerator, again, a C-armed accelerator. Patient lies on the table here, and then this can rotate around the patient, and in doing so, it will deliver radiation dose. I've got a movie that I'll show you in a minute that shows an actual application of dose to a patient. So patient flow then. Patient gets consulted, informed consent, of course, as far as what the intent is of the treatment, what are the possible side effects that the patient may suffer from the treatment. Treatment simulation then is the first step, where we acquire digital representations of the patient anatomy, either a CT scan or an MR scan or some other imaging, so that we can get an idea where the target might be. Right? You can't usually see where the patient's target is just by looking at the patient. You have to look inside. So we have to have some imaging that allows us to define what the target is going to be for our radiation therapy. Treatment planning then proceeds, where we actually simulate how radiation is going to interact with that patient's specific anatomy so that we can get an idea of what the distribution of dose is going to be, and then make sure that that dose distribution will provide the kind of outcome that we are hoping for that patient, so that we can satisfy the goal, put as much dose into the target, keep as little dose as possible in the normal structures that are there. And then we do all sorts of verification as well, as you can imagine, before we put the patient on the table to make sure that the application is going to be safe. Some imaging equipment, devices that have been used, CT scanner, of course, that's kind of the bread and butter still of imaging for radiation therapy. PET scans have been used. MR, of course, is also very useful because it provides better imaging of soft tissue. Here's an example of that, where we have a patient. This is a coronal reconstruction of a patient's CT scan. This is an MR scan. So certainly on the MR, you can see some abnormality here, right? Probably some sort of tumor. Whereas on the CT scan, you see a hint of it, but it certainly isn't as impressive from the perspective of telling you that there are problems. So oftentimes, we do what's called multimodality imaging, where we will combine a patient's CT scan with MR or maybe with PET or other imaging modalities to get a full picture of what the patient's problem might be so that we can more effectively define the target for radiation therapy. Here's an example of a nuclear medicine study for a patient where you've got a full bone scan. We apply a radioisotope to the patient, allow it to distribute through the patient's anatomy, and generally you're going to get accumulation in the bladder over here, the bones, and then other locations where you don't expect to see accumulation is usually an indication of higher metabolic activity, which can be indicative of a malignant process. So here, for example, this patient has some sort of metastatic disease, right? Disease that has traveled away from the location of the primary cancer that is very important for us to know as we define what kind of treatment the patient's going to get. So this is just one aspect of the imaging process that can provide very useful information to us. Once we get an idea of what the patient's target is, right, we call that the gross tumor volume, what we see on the image, right, either the CT scan or the MR, we then have a few other concepts that we need to take into account. One is we know that, generally speaking, the tumor that we see on the image, it has microscopic extension into adjacent tissue that may not look malignant on the image. So we account for that through the application and derivation of this CTV. It's called the clinical target volume. So that includes all the disease that we can see that's obvious on the scan, plus some known region away from there that includes subclinical microscopic disease. It's very important because that microscopic disease, if you don't treat it, the same that you're treating the primary tumor, it's just going to grow back afterwards. So you have to include a margin that gives you irradiation of that microscopic disease. Now, this particular margin, this target, it might move, right? As a patient breathes, you can't have them hold their breath or stop breathing during treatment. So if you're treating something in the thorax, you might have to include an additional margin which will cover the complete excursion of the clinical target volume as a patient breathes, right? So that then creates the ITV, the internal target volume, and then you have another margin that you add to that to give you the planning target volume. And that includes, that gives you, it allows for any kind of setup inaccuracy as the dose is delivered from one day to the next. Because remember, the patient comes for treatment every day. They might be a little bit different on day two relative to the way they were on day one. So we account for that by having another additional margin over here. So when we plan our treatment, it's the size of the PTV that becomes a target for us. And that includes what we see as tumor, plus a whole bunch of other concepts that are also very important to provide the whole picture of what's going to happen to that patient. So here's an example. Patient for prostate cancer. Again, this is a CT slice through the mid-pelvis. We've got the bladder up here in yellow, the rectum is down here, and then this is the prostate, sort of sandwiched between the bladder and the rectum. So the prostate would be the GTV, the primary target. That's where the disease is. And then we have other expansions here, right? The CTV will include an expansion that might give us an idea where the subclinical or microscopic disease might be. And then we have the PTV that gives us the ability to irradiate a little more tissue because we know that the patient's prostate may not be in exactly the same location every day that the patient comes for treatment. And then we have organs at risk, which would be the bladder and the rectum that we don't want to irradiate much if we can avoid them. So this then becomes the target, PTV over here. And you can see that it does extend a little bit into the bladder and the rectum, but there's no way around that, unfortunately. So when we plan treatments, then we would want to make sure that whatever treatment we plan for this patient, it's going to cover that planning target volume, the PTV, which includes the prostate plus the margins that we discussed. So this is the treatment planning process. Here is a transverse CT slice, again showing the bladder, the rectum, prostate, then we have reconstructions, coronal, sagittal, and then this kind of 3D reconstruction of the bony anatomy plus the soft tissue. Once we do the treatment planning, then this would be an evaluation of what the dose is going to look like. Kind of like the color wash that we saw for that head and neck patient earlier, where now the hot part of the dose distribution, right, the red color, we want that to overlap with the patient's prostate plus margin. And that's in fact what you see over here. And then the blue part of the distribution, which is colder, we want that to be in the regions where the patient's bladder might be and where the patient's rectum certainly is. And then other organs at risk here are the femoral heads, which you see outlined in green. Those we certainly don't want to overdose either. And then we'll look at this distribution in different planes of view. So here we have a coronal reconstruction. Patient's head is up here, the feet are down here. And then here's a sagittal reconstruction, showing the vertebral column over here, the coccyx way down here, bladder, rectum, and so on. And we can look at dose in any of these views and make sure that in each view we're satisfying the goals. Putting the dose in the target, keeping the dose away from the normal structures that are surrounding the target. Here's just a close-up again showing the prostate and how the red part of the distribution nicely matches the shape of the prostate plus margin and how the blue part goes into the organs at risk that we talked about. Here's another example, another case where this patient has some sort of a tumor growing on the vertebral part of their adjacent to the spinal cord over here. So this is the target that we need to irradiate, and this is a very critical structure that we don't want to irradiate, the spinal cord. And what we see is that the dose distribution nicely matches the shape of the target, and at the same time the blue part of the distribution nicely conforms to where the spinal cord is, and also where the lungs are and the mediastinum up here and the soft tissue in the posterior part of the patient's back. So this is all terrific. These are all great dose distributions. Here's a sagittal view of the same thing where you can see how here's the patient's spinal cord, and you can see how he's got some impingement on the spinal cord. This is some metastatic lesion that's growing over here. If this is allowed to continue growing, eventually it will transect the cord. Patient will either become paralyzed or permanently, or it may not be permanent, but in any case, the patient will be in trouble. So if we can apply this radiation dose, hopefully we can prevent that from happening for that patient. But we have to make sure that we don't apply it in such a way that we end up paralyzing the patient by overdosing the spinal cord, right? So we have to be very careful with how we apply that dose. So let's look real quick at, let's see if this works. Okay, good. So what you're going to see now is an application of radiation in our clinic to a patient. So here we have the beam, the radiation machine. Patient's lying on a table. The patient is being treated for some head and neck malignancy. He's got a mask on his head, which immobilizes him so that he doesn't move during treatment. And as this machine is rotating around the patient, the shape of the radiation beam, which emanates in this direction, always pointed towards the patient, is being modified such that its shape matches the shape of the tumor in that projection. So this dose delivery will continue all the way around the patient, and that will represent one fraction, one day, of that patient's treatment. This patient will have to come for treatment every day for 35 fractions. Generally 7 weeks, 5 days a week of treatment. And each day that the patient comes, they will receive one of these applications. And this is real time. So we're going to allow this to play all the way through, but you can see how we've got about 1 minute that has elapsed so far. It'll take another 30 seconds or so to get down to the bottom. There was some setup that was required, right, so that we know we have the patient lined up properly relative to the radiation beam. All told, this patient's entire treatment schedule will be about 10 minutes per day. That's what it would take. So not bad, not bad. We'll just let this finish, and now it's done. So this patient at this point would come off the table and would go home for the day and then come back tomorrow for an identical application. We do this about 150 to 160 times a day to patients that come to our clinic. So for that patient, this would be the dose distribution that we would produce. Right? It was a head and neck tumor, so you know we've got this nice overlay of the high part of the radiation dose to what we've identified as the patient's target, patient's tumor. Here's another view. This is a transverse view, so here is where the patient's tumor is, and you can see how the cold parts of the distribution are, in fact, the parotid gland, which is right here, is carved out of the distribution, which is very nice. Spinal cord is also carved out. And then parts of the salivary glands, which are over here, are included in the blue part of the distribution. Only the region that we want to treat, that we need to treat, is in the red part of the distribution. So that's considered a very good treatment for this particular patient. Last slide. So the goals of modern radiation therapy, then, are to improve tumor control, right? And that could mean either preventing a tumor from growing, maybe causing the tumor to regress a little bit. That would be good as well. It does happen occasionally. And the way we do that is by increasing the probability of tumor control, right? But at the same time, we also have to reduce morbidity. We want our patients to have a good quality of life when they're done with us. And that we can only do by decreasing dose to normal tissue. So those are sort of competing complications that we have. And the way we get around that is by using very complex treatment techniques. What I showed you with the machine rotating around the patient, that's something relatively new. That is a treatment technique that only came into development and maybe mainstream application only about 5 to 7 years ago. Okay? So that's something that is really very new. And there are going to be many, many new technologies that are going to be introduced. They're currently in the development and research phases, but will eventually come to mainstream application that hopefully will allow us to get an even better control and a better way of satisfying these goals of radiation therapy. Okay, I think I'll stop there. Are there any questions? No? Okay, thank you all.